and sixth edition. Stay tuned. Too much brown downtown in Santa Cruz. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop's Pier's Broadside, 6 to 8 p.m. show every Thursday, and do a longer one on Sunday mornings. It's all about civil rights, or where are they, in Santa Cruz, and sometimes in the broader area. We cover San Jose, San Francisco, sometimes jump as far as New York or Iraq. What a concept. You can join us in this examination, this exploration, this attempt to actually really find out what's happening in our own community by dialing 427-3772. That's Free Radio Santa Cruz's studio line here, and I'm here in the studio, and you can be here with me, and we can both be talking to the community back and forth if you'd like. Again, 427-3772 is the phone number. If you want to catch me off air because you're feeling a little shy, or possibly you haven't quite got things ready for broadcast, or you've got some other questions you might want to raise or comments, the number for that is 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's a voicemail that I use and also is used by Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom for civil rights issues, personal messages, and so forth. And there's actually a description of what it's all about at the beginning of the, there's an outgoing message there that'll tell you about it. Again, 423-HUFF for personal and off-air messages for me, 427-3772, 427-3772, if you want to be a part of the show. You can also reach the Free Radio Santa Cruz voicemail, which is a place where you can leave public service announcements, give donations, ask questions, perhaps offer to join the collective, whatever you'd like about the Free Radio station generally at 427-4523, 427-4523. Most of these numbers you can pick up by going to the website, freakradio.org, where you can also give us a hefty contribution. We can use it. We can always use it. The station is always kind of running on a shoestring, and also we're having lots of trouble with corrupted tapes, hackers, and so forth, as our computer keeps getting infected. It's a sick, sick computer. Today, for instance, I couldn't open any, either Firefox or, well, I couldn't get online, frankly, is just sort of the bottom line. So any techies in the area, Free Radio's vicinity, come rolling down here and help out. I'm going to be proceeding with the show anyway because I've got lots of ancient audio tapes that I play. Plus, of course, I like to babble at great length on the air. And hopefully you'll babble with me. Again, 427-3772 is the number to call in. HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the once proud and now faltering civil rights organization for homeless people, does continue to meet on Wednesdays at 9:30 in the morning at the county building. And you can go check out a meeting there if you want to be a volunteer in some way because you want to provide your expertise or you want to be helpful but you hate meetings. You can, again, call the HUFF line at 423-HUFF. The meetings are, again, 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning on Wednesday at the county building in the atrium, between the county building, actually, and the courthouse, and the kind of the grassy, well, it's not grassy, it's an indoor area where you walk between the two buildings, and there's a coffee cart there, and so are we. So that's kind of the usual beginning to my show for those thousands of people who've just joined me and don't know what I talk about and so forth and what HUFF does. I've most recently been preoccupied with a court case, which those who regularly listen to this station have heard about. There are actually two of them. One of them that involves my liberty is the criminal court case against me for disrupting a public meeting about 14 months ago. I didn't disrupt the meeting, but that's the claim by the district attorney, and that was the claim by Michael Rotkin, the then mayor and city council member who had me elected. Here is a call. Maybe that could be Mike calling in to apologize. Is that possible? Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to ask Robert to make a technical public service announcement.
Okay.
Yeah, ask him to have the guy in the red caravan turn the radio down.
All right. Mr. Caravan Man, get that radio down.
Yes.
Does that feel better now?
It would be great. It's a totally roundabout way. I could shout out my window, but it would be kind of technologically freaky.
I see.
How do you know have it come out of the van.
Well, actually, I should probably suggest that he turn it louder if he's listening to free radio. So I don't know what to tell you. Turn that radio up, Mr. Caravan Man.
No, don't do that.
No, I shouldn't do
that.
Don't
do that.
Okay.
He doesn't want to get a ticket.
Well, certainly not. That'd be amplified sound, and that would be a citation, yeah. So, what's anything else you request?
Robert?
Yes. Hello?
Robert, we want to go to bed.
You want to go to bed with...
Tell Robert this is Nigel. and Caravan Man needs to turn it down.
That's actually already been done. You're going out on the air yourself,
right,
Nigel.
I could hear it. It's excellent. Okay.
Yes, yes. Well, you see, there is a delay, but, you know, nonetheless, it gets out there.
That's the technological
Anything else
part.
Other than these frivolous comments, Nigel? I take it not.
It's not frivolous.
Hey, certainly not. Anything more you want to say?
No, thank you. No, thank you.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Well, not frivolous. I don't know about that. It's always nice to be of service to somebody who wants somebody else's radio turned down, but that's not the real function of our show here. I was, again, talking about a court case, and the court case happened, well, it's been happening for 14 months, one court hearing after another, and I went to one yesterday, and unfortunately I was not allowed to tape record the court hearing. Not given a good reason for it either, actually not given any real reason for it, other than the fact that a, quote, transcript could be obtained. Of course, that would cost a lot of money to obtain a transcript and take a certain significant amount of time and would not be available to people who are low income, and it's just generally another barrier that the courts throw up. I actually have complained about this at length on the story I wrote about my recent court appearance yesterday on IndieBay.org. And would that I could go there, but I unfortunately do not seem able to do that on this computer. So you can go there, though. IndieBay.org/Santa Cruz is Indie Media for Santa Cruz, which I still use. And it's got a story in the right-hand column about my court case, and which I've recently updated this afternoon. So if you want to check it out, you can. For those who haven't got computers in their cars or haven't got computers at all, what happened was this. This is a hearing that will, to some extent, limit or not limit testimony that comes into the trial, which begins on September 25th. I'm charged with two counts, one of disrupting a public assembly, 403 PC, if you will, and then another of obstructing an officer in the performance of their duties, and that's, I think, 148 PC. Both these charges are bogus, and I believe won't stand before a jury. I'm beginning to stutter, so maybe you don't think I'm clear about this or sure about this, but it's, and in fact, who knows what a jury will decide. They actually once convicted me for serving free food to poor people at Civic Center in San Francisco in 1994. And so I would have thought that unlikely and impossible before a San Francisco jury, but I was wrong. So I could be wrong again. It's hard to tell what a Santa Cruz jury will do. However, in this particular hearing, the issue was, well, I'm accused of standing before the microphone at City Council and trying to talk for 2 minutes on an afternoon agenda item involving IATSE, and a union that was involved in, that is still involved in, workers at the Civic Auditorium. And there's a rule at City Council that was created by Councilmember Rotkin and then later passed by the entire council after it was sort of unilaterally declared by Rotkin, that individuals who are speaking on so-called consent agenda items, which is about half, actually more than half the agenda, and usually involves a lot of substantial items, which City Council does not want to talk about, they just want to vote on very quickly. Usually you're allowed 1 or 2 or 3 minutes on these items for every item you pull off the agenda, and usually people pull off 1 or 2, sometimes 3 or 4, but almost never more than that. I think the most I've ever pulled off is 5. And Rotkin didn't like the kind of dialogue, I think, that developed in the five items that I pulled off in a February council meeting, plus the fact that other people kind of stood up and joined in at this, and the council had to take time to argue issues that they would normally not even have to address at all. A lot of this was around the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel and consultants' fees, even before there was any kind of final decision being made on it. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were at stake. I was wondering why this kind of money was being rushed through and so forth. And interestingly enough, the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel was defeated as a project, which some people favor and some people didn't. But Rotkin decided that my commentary was unwanted, and so they created this rule. And the rule states that you can only have a total of 5 minutes for all comments, all put together. So if there are 25 items, you get to speak for 5 minutes divided by 25 on each item, if you want to talk on each item, which no one ever does. But it really severely limits the time. Usually, you know, there might be three or four items. You might want to talk for 2 minutes on each. You can't do that anymore. You can talk for 5 minutes on all the items you're interested in, or on any one item for up to 3 minutes, then the other items for combined for up to 2 minutes. So it's been considerable cutback in public comment time. I felt this was a violation of the Brown Act, the law that makes it illegal, that requires City Council to provide public comment time on every item and does not allow the council to censor people's comments based upon their content, and that also allows them the right to be at public meetings, even if the city officials don't like them there for one reason or another. And I've tried to invoke these provisions at different times with respect to city council misbehavior. Years ago, for example, when the city council, and as it still does, refuses to provide meaningful, adequate restroom facilities, which particularly impact poor and homeless people, I brought the Golden Potty Award to be delivered to Mayor Byers, and I was threatened with arrest by Councilmember Sugar for doing that, and informed that I would be arrested if I brought this kind of a little commode, a gold-painted commode weighing about 8 or 9 pounds, into the city council chambers. At other times, I've been removed from the chambers for a comment from the audience, for example, when the mayor was repeatedly interrupting another speaker, Becky Johnson, in a midnight session where they killed the safe sleeping zones. And, in fact, I was never charged with any kind of disruption at any of these evictions, but the city council doesn't need to charge you. They can just call the cops, have you removed, claim you're disrupting a meeting, and then, in some cases, bar you from the next meeting. Rotkin believes that's something you can do, although that's not, I don't think that's actually allowed in the Brown Act. You're allowed to attend public meetings in spite of that, but it has been done by this city council. Anyway, at this hearing yesterday, the district attorney, Archie Weber, who's the district attorney who's been doggedly pursuing this case month after month for 14 months, with the full approval of Bob Lee, the liberal DA who doesn't mind busting medical marijuana providers like Roger Minch, I went into this hearing with two attorneys, volunteer attorneys Kate Wells and David Beauvais. And I guess what I'll do is I'll let you hear a little bit of the interview. Well, actually, it's not a very long interview. It's the interview in the hallway with attorney Kate Wells. And the issue here was how much allegation of disruption at earlier council meetings could be brought into my September 25th trial coming up in 3 weeks, or actually about 4 weeks.
And at high noon, or actually 10 o'clock in the morning, outside Department 1, the court of the new judge, Deneen J. Guy, who will be hearing my case. I'm Robert Norris, also known as Robert N. Kahn, and I'm talking to attorney Kate Wells, who's going to be involved in this case, and has... What are we talking about here today, Kate? Why are we here at this hearing?
We're here because the district attorney wants to bring up issues at trial that we think should be excluded from the jury's knowledge. Those include charges that were made as long ago as 7 years, charges against you.
Murder, rape?
Disrupting meeting.
of course, that's what the object of the prosecution will be if we go to trial on September 25th, as is scheduled, right?
Right. At any rate, they want to bring up charges that were never filed. No criminal charges were ever filed. So, in effect, you never had a chance to defend yourself against these charges. And if they're going to be able to bring those up in court at this point, you know, we think that we should, you know, have trials on each one of these charges. So that's basically what's happening.
What about our charge on the pitch of smoking? You know, to get that
Well, we know who it is now. We have him, and I have talked to him, and I'm going to. He is willing to cooperate with us.
Impeach's motion is a motion that was made to get the names and contact points for people who might impeach the testimony of Lieutenant Steve Clark, who is the arresting officer, and the basis for a second charge of resisting arrest, when in fact I was arrested before I was informed I was under arrest, and once I was told I was under arrest, I didn't resist at all.
Right. As well as the lying, and the complaint was made by an investigator for the district attorney's office, actually, against Lieutenant Steve Clark. Actually, at the time, he was Sergeant Steve Clark, that he lied in a declaration. In fact, I should talk to Archie about that. Archie?
And the hearing happened, and I'll kind of give you the skivvy, though. To read in more detail, you might go, as I said, to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. The district attorney presented a somewhat fumbling presentation in response to a rather extensive written counter motion that attorneys David Beauvais and Kate Wells had filed. That was Kate Wells you heard talking. The district attorney claimed that, you know, you could bring in all these old cases of disruption because, not to show that I was a bad character, but rather to show that I should have known that there were laws at city council or rules at city council that govern city council, and so it would go to that. And it might also go to show that I had a capacity to intend to disrupt the city council meeting because of past misbehavior. My attorney argued, for all you legal buffs out there, that the crime I'm being accused with is not attempting to disrupt a council meeting, but it is supposedly engaging in behavior that actually does disrupt a council meeting. And that's really the issue. If they can prove that, they don't have to prove that I intended to do it. They don't have to prove that I attempted to do it. They don't have to prove there's a history of it. All they have to prove that the council was disrupted. That's all they have to prove. And that was my attorney's response. You don't need to bring in these past issues. The second argument he had, in any case, the matter was pretty much resolved. The judge went into chambers, came back 3 hours later, and said that, you don't have to prove, our side is going to admit that I stood at the microphone, that I did all the things they said that I did, because it's recorded on videotape, that I didn't immediately leave the microphone when Rotkin demanded I leave, at least not instantaneously, and that I knew the rules, but that nonetheless what I did was not a substantial disruption of the council meeting. No, that was done by Mayor Mike Rotkin, who stopped the meeting, just as Kennedy before him had stopped a meeting when I was at the microphone, and Christopher Crone before him had stopped a meeting. These council members are good at stopping meetings in order to intimidate the public. Most people then kind of quietly skulk away, myself included. I don't like having to spend months and months going to court to justify myself and protect myself from several years of probation or possibly even jail if I don't take probation. So people will, you know, do what the city council members tell them to do, even if the city council members are violating their rights, and even if they have a right to speak, and even if what's being done is a violation of the Brown Act or a violation of the Constitution. So I'm not the bravest guy in the world, and frankly, in this case, I wasn't the smartest guy in the world, because it's a 14-month legal battle is not, frankly, my idea of a good time, though some people may doubt it. It doesn't give me an opportunity to babble about it on the radio, but there are all kinds of other things to babble about on the radio, too. But since this issue is here, I do want to say that the outcome of this hearing was the judge said, no, you can't, to the prosecution, you can't bring in past instances of alleged disruption. And one of the reasons that she did this was, this is Judge Deneen Guy, it's not because she's such a wonderful judge. I wasn't terribly impressed with her as a judge and how she behaved toward other people, and how she behaved toward me, too, for that matter. But because if she had granted this motion and allowed the district attorney to bring in all this stuff, we would have had the opportunity to challenge each particular alleged past disruption and to show that rather than being a disruption, it was repression by the city council against a member of the public who was a critic. And thereby, we could call all the past mayors to talk about this. We could subpoena, you know, the city attorney, the city manager, recipient witnesses to talk about it. We would subpoena our own. It would turn into a major circus. Now, you might say, well, 14 months later, why don't you want a major circus? Aren't we trying to expose this issue before the community? And the answer is sure. The problem is the two attorneys I have are not getting paid to do this. And they are not interested in spending, you know, weeks and weeks. I have a long, long trial. They have a living. They have a, you know, a living to make. They have other things to do. Beauvais lives in Berkeley. He's an activist who I've worked with in the past, and he's helped me in other cases. They didn't sign on to a job that would involve such a huge case. So one of the problems I had was that the attorneys were simply not up for it. The second reason I didn't proceed along this path, which I could have done. When the district attorney made the tactical error of, I think it was an error, of trying to include all this old stuff about disruption, if I had had the willing attorneys, I would then also need some supporters who wanted to do some work on this issue, because it really requires some preparation to go through all these old cases, to subpoena all the witnesses. It's quite an undertaking. And it could be done, but it would require a lot of footwork, some research paperwork, and at the moment, those resources don't seem to be in evidence. So I didn't demand that my attorneys not contest the DA's motion, and in fact, they were doing what they thought was right. This is the way to win the case, because even though I could have made the whole trial a trial of the Santa Cruz City Council, the odds are that people who are frankly more subservient to authority than ever these days, you know, you come to a metal detector and everybody bends over, you know, spreads their cheeks and says, "How wide?" You see this every day right in the courthouse with the metal detector. People are willing to do what they're told and often to believe what they're told, whether it's the, you know, Stalinist left or the Republican right. I mean, it's all kind of depressing in many ways. People all march together in lockstep. So I don't know that a jury wouldn't have said, all these mayors said Mr. Norris was disruptive. He obviously was disruptive. Guilty. And then I would have had to go to, appeal at best, jail at worst, and I know, and decide whether I wanted to surrender essentially my right to speak and act as a free agent by taking probation, which means anytime a police officer looks at you cross-eyed, he can drag you into court for police contact. Any kind of violation of the law of any sort becomes the basis for an alleged probation violation, and you don't get a jury trial for that. You just get a hearing. And you don't get the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. You just get preponderance of the evidence, which means they show by 51% that maybe you were not obeying the law, and therefore away you go off to jail. And it's something that has to be weighed. I'm still pretty adamant at the moment in saying I'm not going to take any probation, even if I'm found guilty of this charge. And the trial is still on. This trial is on for September 25th. Next month, obviously, September is next month. So if you're still interested in this issue, if you want to come to court, I welcome people to be supportive. The real issue is the city council's repressive behavior. And this kind of happens every council meeting. And one of the things I've learned over the last couple of years, much as I continue to talk about the issue on the air, is the city council is really kind of a hopeless case. It's, you know, it's not, it's like Representative Farr, you know, it's like trying to argue civil liberties with Mike Rotkin. It's talking to a wall, pretty much. And I don't say this intending to be offensive or hostile to these individuals, although I'm hostile to their positions and to the damage they've done. Farr, on his refusal to fight the war, to stand up against military appropriations. And Rotkin, of course, on a whole panoply of civil liberties violations that he not only supports, but that he rewrites so that it looks like they are not civil liberties violations. The most obvious and the most flagrant of which is the sleeping ban for homeless people. And we've talked about that and debated about that ad nauseum on this show in the past. That's the law that criminalizes homeless people after dark, or I should say after 11 o'clock at night. This in a city that has you know, 5% shelter, and so the rest of the time you're subject to a $90 fine and all kinds of penalties. So I think the city council is not really the best use of people's time. But in fact, the city council right now is the representative body, supposedly, the legislative body locally. So it's the place people should have a right to go to and should be able to be heard. All these shoulds, you know, one bridle is at this. One says, why isn't it so? And of course, it isn't so for all the reasons that there's injustice in the world. Entrenched power will have its way and is and does have its way. So, obviously, we need to develop alternate centers of power. I mean, city council actually does pay attention when you bring 100 people to city council, or 20 people to city council, for that matter. You know, city council does pay attention when there are large street protests. And large street protests and even festive protests can unmask police repression, as we saw happen with the last night DIY activity, where an innocent and joyous celebration became the target of undercover political surveillance and exposed the fact that the police department is A, doing this, B, corruptly assigning the same people who authorized it to investigate it, C, we have a city manager who thinks nothing wrong with this, and D, we have a police chief whose response to this is to essentially ratify it after the fact. And all these facts came out because of people organizing on their own. Rico Thunder and bunches of other people organizing. And I think they're doing it again for next this next year, last night parade, which, frankly, I think the police are going to back off from. But that, of course, doesn't mean that they've backed off from surveilling other political activities. We have no way of knowing what they're doing. The guidelines that were presented and that Scary unilaterally, were put in place unilaterally by Police Chief Scary, Howard Scary, and then okayed by Cynthia Matthews without any kind of real public hearing, real public input, real discussion, examination, or, you know, just coming clean as to what's been surveyed in the last 2 or 3 years by the police department. Anyway, alternate kinds of protests and focus is perhaps much more productive than city council is one of my conclusions. I haven't yet found the road forward on this issue. I mean, there are different bodies of people to go to appeal to, people who have maybe various interests, some of whom may be, I don't know, right-wingers in many respects, people who are gun lovers, people who are anti-choice people in some respects. I found some of the people most intensively assertive of the rights of poor people often have been people who are kind of fundamentalists in some respects. Now, in other times, of course, you know, you get people who are who buy into the welfare cheat propaganda, into the, you know, the claims of, you know, there's no real poverty here, we can all do it if we only try, and so forth. But also, some people have also experienced some pretty nasty things at the hands of local government and, to some extent, local businesses and local in terms of, well, we're going to see a battle coming up in November around the minimum wage. So while I brood on my own thoughts here, and while you do too, you can always call in to discuss any of these issues at 427-3772. I'm going to play a little more, a few interviews from the street, and I'm going to also whip out a few articles here, and we can talk about those. Some of the stuff, as I mentioned, that I wanted to discuss, I can't because the computer is down, or if it's not really down, but the internet doesn't seem to be interneting. But luckily, we have the occasional phone caller who possibly can add some something to this. Hello, you're on Free Radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Robert.
Yes.
Hey, I was just calling about the court case that we were discussing.
Hi, this is Uncle Doug?
It is, Uncle Doug.
Well, Doug, I know that you, I remember you fighting for against a camping ticket up at UCSC a decade ago, man.
Yep, two tickets.
And you actually, you fought it out on the court of Art Danner, and I guess you lost, right?
It was a slight, like, victory from the jaws of defeat sort of thing. It was on joint Santa Cruz and UC property. So they were going to charge me with the UC penalty, which was $160-some that the camping ban used to be. But then they ended up at the last minute giving me the $55 Santa Cruz ticket. So that was better for sure.
Now, did you do community service on that ticket, or did you pay a fine?
I'm pretty sure I paid a fine for that one.
That was a minor improvement made instead of real reform of the sleeping ban back in 99 when they reduced the fine from $162 to $54. Now it's actually $90. It's gone up.
Oh, it went up again.
Yeah, because of assessments by the court, not because of a change by the city council. But they also provided a maximum of 8 hours of community service, which judges have routinely been violating.
Uh-huh.
Although that's because they're so bored with homeless cases, they don't even read the law. And the attorneys who defend the homeless people, at least one of them, Tony Bowl, was also so bored he didn't read the law. And when he did read it, he was not willing to stand up before a judge because he thought it would offend her.
Wait, what's the content of that law again? I wasn't sure.
Says you should have a fine essentially of no more than now it's $90 and 8 hours of community service for either sleeping or covering up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night in the city limits.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that, too.
Right, but I know, though, that recently you've been engaging in some criminal capers on the beach.
Yeah, another one of those outdoor sort of criminal activities.
Well, hardy criminal that you are. Tell us about that.
Well, it's the whole you aren't allowed to be on the beach after 10 o'clock at night deal.
Is this sort of because of a terrorist alert or Japanese subs coming in? I mean, what's going on here?
It's a little boggling. I'm not sure. You know, why? It's like, it was a Friday night. It's like, it was back when the sun was setting at like 9:30 at night, and you were supposed to be out of there at 10. Some of these things, the trip I'm thinking about, some of their, the deal with like the economics of like why people are maybe getting more tickets. I know I've had, way too many interactions with police recently, it seems like, and that I think there's some kind of a trying to maybe even make more money or something, or maybe there's cutbacks on the number of park rangers, so they're like, we got to do it early, or something. I'm not sure all the reasons for it.
When did you get this citation?
It was about 2 months ago.
And do you recall, was this a city park ranger, John Wallace, or was it some other state person? Or?
His name, I think, was Dallas Stone. Was his name?
Probably a state ranger or somebody else.
Yeah, it's a state park ranger.
And what were the circumstances? Give us the grim details.
Well, we were there enjoying ourselves on a Friday evening of somebody's birthday, and it was like 10 o'clock, and the guy came by, and he's like, "Yeah, you guys got to get going," and we're like, "Oh, great," and. So we kind of slowly started like picking our stuff up, and then they came back. But we had like a little like a fire circle thing, like the inside of a laundry machine.
How many were you?
There was maybe like 10 or 15 of us.
Uh-huh.
And so we had to wait for this thing to cool down that the wood was in. So that was kind of the last thing to pack up, and they came back and. I had totally packed up, and people were moving along, and I was kind of on the periphery there, myself and another individual, and I was just like, yeah, we're just about out of here, and guy's like, let me see your ID, and I'm like, am I being ticketed? And he's like, yeah, and he's like, what's your name? And I just kind of stared at him for a little while, probably about 5 seconds or so, and he's like, "You're not giving me your name." And he put his ticket book away, and I'm like, "Okay," and I started giving it to him, and he's like, "No, it's too late." And he kind of twisted my arm, and then like handcuffed me actually right there.
Now the name of this eager officer, this should we say power-seeking, control freakish kind of guy was.
Let's see. I could actually dig. I think it was Collis Stone. I think his name was like. I wish I could remember off the top of my head.
And how many backups did he have to deal with you and your terrorist mob?
Oh, wait, here. I got the information right here.
All right.
He had two other kind of guys there that were standing there. And one other guy kind of started searching somebody else's stuff, and the person was quite aware of their rights, was like, I don't consent to a search during the whole thing. Oh, this guy, R. Callison, badge number 1184.
How do you spell it?
Callison.
And what kind of an officer was he?
He was a state park ranger.
Okay. And none of his colleagues.
Big bald guy.
Okay. And so he handcuffed you to make sure that you didn't begin assaulting him with sticks of wood or bits of sand or...
Well, it was bizarre because shortly thereafter, the guy actually asked me, he looked at my backpack, and he's like, you know, you got anything in there? And I'm just like, you know, you can't look in there. And he's just like, yeah, you got it. It was either, I don't remember if he said, like, bomb or explosives that he asked me.
But he did ask you about something that went boom, boom.
He asked me if I had, like, a bomb or something. And then he ended up, he just ended up writing me the rest of the ticket with my handcuffs on. And other people were there and kind of giving him a little bit of a hard time because they're like, you know, you're out of hand and, like, you know, you're totally out of line. We're just getting ready to leave. And, like, you know, it was just being way over the top. And so then he started, he got the rest of my info. I kept giving it a little bit slowly, of course, so that, you know, he wouldn't want to finish quickly and go help out some other people. But
now, did other people stay on the beach, I guess, because it's illegal to be on the beach, I guess, but it's not illegal to be out in public yet after 10 o'clock.
Well, you aren't allowed to even be anywhere on the beach, I guess, not even at a campfire.
So others moved off the beach, or were they still there in solidarity?
They were packing up, and they were pretty much getting ready. Like, most people, by this time, like, people are getting ticketed, and they're just, you know, they're like, trying to carry stuff off, and so it's pretty much clearing out, but people wanted to stick around a little bit just to make sure that they weren't going to mess with us too much.
So you had a number of criminals violating the "we're on the beach after dark" law.
After 10 o'clock, you're not allowed to be on the beach.
And how many of these criminals got their comeuppance with citations?
Two of us. One other guy.
Was the other guy handcuffed as well?
No, he wasn't. Just me.
And you finally, you identified yourself verbally, or you showed him ID?
I said verbally.
Okay, and did he reach into your pocket and look at your wallet, or?
He kind of patted me down. He's like, "Oh, is that your wallet?" You know, I'm just like, I didn't really say.
So then what happened?
Then I mean, after he ended up, getting my information, then he ended up, he actually took the handcuffs off at that point, and then we left. And then I just recently saw him again in court.
So before you go any further,
yeah.
How long did it take this case to appear? Did you get a notification in the mail? What happened after that?
I did, yeah. I got a notification, and then so.
And the notification said that you could pay a bail and drop the whole thing. They could, if you paid off the court, you know, a little hush money, that it would all go away, right?
Yeah. But this is another astounding fact. Like, I mean, I've approached a few people about this, but like, how much do you think it is, you know, for like being on the beach a little bit late? And, you know, people have 50, 70 bucks, something. $195 for being on the beach after 10 o'clock at night.
Well, you're helping to fund the park ranger's retirement fund.
These guys are insane, I think.
So
I was basically debating him for a while there and like was like, you know, do you even believe in this? And the guy was like, you know, no.
What did he say?
I was debating him about whether he even like believed in this ridiculous law or not, like adults being on the beach at 10 o'clock at night. And he's like, well, I haven't taken like a survey. I'm like, well, everybody I've ever talked to is like thinks it's absolutely ridiculous. You know,
and so that was the reason he was putting you in handcuffs and writing you citations, and not writing anyone else citations.
He didn't after that. No, somebody else like kind of knew them and sort of was able to slightly like, you know, make them back down a little bit. They kind of, I don't know how they were able to do it, and they kind of knew them a little bit. And but yeah, they
sort of the buddy buddy approach.
Well, just somehow, yeah, they knew them somehow. And
so you got a notice in the mail that said, yeah, that it was $195 to clear it up.
Yeah.
So did you decide you'd pay it off and walk away from it?
No, I set bail and then set a court date at the same time, which, of course, I realized later is the wrong move.
You do not have to pay bail to set a court date.
Yeah, although you do need to appear before the judge. So I thought, well, I'll just save myself one more court date, and I'll, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, actually, usually what you do is you, unless you're going to disqualify referee basket, which is a very good idea.
Yeah,
still,
I didn't see that, which I should have.
I recommend everybody disqualify referee basket using a 170.6 CCP motion. Get your pencils out, write it down, 170.6 CCP, and you write. Essentially take it over to the window in the basement of the county building, and it says, I believe referee basket to be prejudiced, and I ask that this be put into another court. You didn't do that. Instead, you made the mistake of not only accepting her, but posting money at the window. Did you immediately get a trial? Did you skip arraignment, or did you have to go through both an arraignment court appearance and a trial court appearance?
There was no arraignment. It was just straight for the trial.
Okay, so you did actually skip a court appearance. I suppose that might be worth something if your time is worth $195 for that court appearance.
I thought that maybe they would. Sometimes they take it down a little bit in the court, or sometimes I don't know. I was remembering incorrectly. I was thinking before. I was like that they might take it down a bit, but that was more that they'll take it down. I think if you don't have the money for bail, I think they'll sometimes. I've seen it happen. They'll be like, well, you know, how about you want to just pay this off $100 and we'll be done with it?
Or alternately, you can get community service. And
yeah.
There are community service organizations that are sympathetic into these kinds of things.
Do you have to still pay for that, by the way? I know a while back.
You do have to put down something of a deposit, but much less. I mean, usually it's $25 to $75. So it's much cheaper to do community service. So you have to pay for it in terms of hours. Now, how long after you kicked down the ransom of $195 for the... You know, for the bail, although you weren't even being held in jail, but I guess for the right to skip the arraignment hearing, did you actually get to your trial?
I think it was about a month after that.
And describe for me what happened. Did you see a number of other trials at the same time?
I did. There was two in front of me, and both of them.
These are trials before a judge in the basement of the county building.
Yeah,
right?
The basement. I'd be interested to know how they've turned out, but. They both, one of them, definitely, the guy caught the police officer lying. He basically got him to change his story within 2 minutes. And about, it was some, like, it was a seatbelt violation. And he got the guy, he totally got the guy to, like, you know, change his story right there after 2 minutes. And it was, so that seemed like it seemed like both the cases in front of me, they were pretty strong. And then there's some other guy who had a decibel case of some sort. Like, the cop said that his decibels were too loud. And I think this guy brought forward the case of that the police officer maybe has to have a meter or something for that. I don't know if that's he brought up that case.
And now, did she announce? This is referee Kim Basket. Did she announce her verdicts in these two cases?
You know what? She gave us the option, and I wasn't sure what to do in this circumstance either. But she's like, you can either hear it later in a few hours or something like that after she's like looked over her books, or else. She'll mail it to you within 5 days. So I don't know if that choice right there too. I don't want to hang out here.
You mean she wouldn't look at the law book while you were there? She'd make you sit and wait for the end of the afternoon.
She said you could either wait for a few hours later in the day, or else she would mail you a verdict within 5 days.
Generally speaking, even Meat Grinder Mulligan, her infamous predecessor, didn't do that, but. I mean, I guess in some cases that's relevant because you know she will at least review the case. But the problem with that is that it denies the public the right to see, you know, the kind of justice she's dispensing. It puts it all into kind of a private context where you and she know what goes on, which is horseshit.
And I didn't know. My case, I was contending there's two issues, actually. One of them is that there actually is in the California Constitution, there's a right to have access to any sort of navigable waterways, sort of a, and they say that you have to have the most liberal, like, sort of, like, laws around that, you know, around access to navigable waterways. It's kind of been one of these lengthy, I don't remember, Section 10, I think, Article 6 or something of our Constitution. So I gave them that. And then also, I thought this is another strong one, too, is the whole the right not to have excessive fines is actually a constitutional amendment, both U.S. and California, to not have an excessive bail or fine. And I don't know if everybody that I've talked to thinks, you know, like $195 is completely excessive for being late on a beach, you know. It's like,
Well, of course, so, I mean, initially, I mean, if anybody were wanting to defend themselves, or if I were trying to defend myself from this charge, you don't have a copy of the law with you.
I do, actually, and I did go over it, and the law library were very informative.
What does it say? The law library, by the way, for those who are interested, is in the same, is actually one door over from the court, Department 10, in the basement where you got the racking from a referee basket. It's in the basement of a county building.
I looked up a few things. I mean, the law library gave me a bunch of websites, and then they showed me the specific violation, and then they kind of channeled me, too, towards, like, who it was who had actually made this law, which is still a little bit, like, out of, like, I haven't actually been able to figure that one out. But the actual law that was violated was that violation of posted orders or special use, special event, film, or collection permit. And this is, no person shall violate any provision of an order posted pursuant to the provision of Section 4301I, hereof including but not limited to prohibited areas, use periods, no alcoholic beverage areas, no smoking areas, and no parking areas, where posted in accordance with 4301Q, or so.
Now, that's an interesting ordinance, and I'd like to maybe get me a copy of it when you see me.
Oh, okay.
Because, I mean, it can be used to enforce city ordinances as well, it sounds like to me. But the issue here is you really have to go back and see, and it's really hard. But this is, it sounds like an infraction, which means the lowest kind of crime in terms of the most least serious kind of crime, infractions, and then misdemeanors, and then felonies are the ascending scale. But you need to have to see in previous cases what actually what was done, and that means you have to shepherdize cases, and you can get the law library staff to help you, but usually this may take an hour or two.
Oh, okay.
And then you have to argue the best thing to argue are you are making constitutional arguments, which isn't bad. I mean, it makes sense.
But more case law.
The first thing you want to argue is reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
You have to find out what the elements of the crime are. That is to say, what two or three things do they have to prove to show that you're violating the law? I mean,
well, this guy brought in a picture of like the hours that were posted at the beach, and it said, you know, it's closed from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And he brought in that picture, and that was his piece of evidence there.
It's hard. It sounds like it's selective enforcement. It obviously is, since your comrade are the only ones ticketed, and the other people in the group were not, right?
I guess. I mean, they maybe just didn't have time to get everybody, or
they could have them all stand off to the side and ticket them one after another. I mean, that's what they could have done, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Instead, I mean, that would have been one line of questioning, but it's hard to find that, use it as a defense. I mean, it's like saying, well, look at all those cars speeding past on the road. Why aren't you ticketing them?
Yeah.
One of the answers is, well, in a car situation, you know, we can't do that. But in this situation, they could have stopped everybody who was on the beach and ticketed them, and they didn't. It sounds like you may have been ticketed because you declined to identify yourself quickly, which, by the way, all you had to do was give your name. Actually, you don't have to say anything to a police officer. You can say, am I being detained or arrested? Then it's even then, theoretically, you don't have to give your name, although it's ACLU advises you to give your name and address. And there's some states where it's criminal. It's a crime not to give your name. I don't think it's a crime in California that they have, I think, charged people with obstructing an officer. Whether they won on those cases, I'm not familiar with that situation.
Yeah, I mean, there are some other strategic things that potentially. I mean, basically, he got his ticket book out, and I asked him, you know, am I getting a ticket? So at that point, he's getting ready to write a ticket. I mean, for me, that's a little bit when like the amicableness ends. For me, as soon as they get out the pen to write the ticket, I'm like, you know, I'm instantly going to be, of course, like, you know, basically trying to delay a little bit so that, like, you know, not everybody gets a ticket there.
I understand that. That might be a good strategy in a certain sense. In another sense, it's considered obstructing or delaying an officer.
Yeah.
And that's actually a misdemeanor crime, Mr. Criminal Guy on the Beach. So,
It was like, I was thinking I could have even developed like maybe a stuttering habit or something like that. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
So,
I think, I don't necessarily disapprove of these strategies. I, I think the problem here is, again, abuse of authority that comes from officers who, anybody in a position of power like that, I think, tends to develop. There is gratification by controlling and, you know, lording it over other people, even if you don't think that can affect you because you're too humanitarian, too anarchist, too reasonable, too humanistic, whatever.
Yeah.
We're talking with Doug, who got a ticket for for being on the beach after hours, ended up paying $195. Can you tell me how long the trial lasted? And did the judge make any comments about your defenses? The problem with excessive bail and fines is you would have to show somehow that that was unusually excessive, and often that's only,
I was thinking that what potentially, I guess, could have seen if there was other places that had, like, that people paid, like, far less or something like that, or maybe go and see if there was hours posted other places, but it was hard to, like, dig up this information of, like, what hours or fines were somewhere else. And
so how long did the trial take?
It was probably over in, like, 4 or 5 minutes.
And you eventually ended up without your $195.
Uh-huh.
And then when you went, you were looking for ways to appeal it or ways to deal with it. You went back to the court window some days later?
Yeah. I went back, and because I said to the judge, I'm like, you know, if I get found guilty, I don't want to. I want to do community service. You know, basically, I don't want to pay it. I want to give these guys economic incentive to, like, go and harass people. So I'm gonna. So I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. And she, I don't remember her exact. I mean, she definitely acknowledged that she heard that. And so
you're talking about Referee Basket.
Referee Basket, yeah.
However, she didn't give you a verdict at the time. That's a reason to ask for an immediate verdict.
Yeah.
Because that way you can then ask for community service immediately. Now, she might have told you the same thing that the woman at the window said, and that apparently you got in the mail, which was that you had to pay the fine, that they'd resolve the whole issue, forget it, we got your money, goodbye, sucker.
Well, they said, I mean, their reasoning was that since I didn't give my my name right away, that that was why she didn't she didn't give me community service.
Now
but it was weird because we didn't go into that issue at all, because that wasn't the issue.
Now, wait a minute. Who told you that? Not Kim Basket.
No, that was the clerk, actually.
Did you get the clerk?
And I was like astounded.
Did you get the clerk's name?
I didn't know. She had, like, kind of reddish, kind of longish.
Right. Always try to get the name of the person who tells you. And what you need to do, perhaps, if you want to pursue it further, just for, you know, curiosity's sake, is to go back to the window and make the same inquiry again.
Yeah.
Then when you get the answer, say, give me a printout of that, please, as to the reasons for that. Unless that's sort of your offhand opinion, I'd like to see if that's mentioned in a record somewhere.
It was posted right there on the computer screen.
Well, then you should go get a copy of the printout. You're entitled to it.
Okay, that's a good idea.
And come back and call me up and let me know what's happening when you've done that.
Okay.
And that will be a $50 charge. You can the check should be in the mail. Address it to Huff of Robert Norris.
Oh, all right. How about the Remnants of Glory show? Could we make it out to them, maybe?
Sure, you could do that too. You actually are a free radio broadcaster, are you not?
Every now and then.
And when is your show?
Actually, I'm on a brief hiatus.
Trying to avoid paying dues, eh?
No. My co-broadcaster is taking over for a while now. He does 9 to 11, the Remnants of Glory show.
And when is that?
Tuesday evenings.
Well, thank you very much, Doug. Any final words or advice for victims
of the
system?
No, I do want to definitely people out there, that if they get a ticket, this Bathrobes Pierre, definite resource here. And I appreciate your got back to me, I think, the same day that I called.
Well, as I said, the $1,000 you put out as a retainer was kind of an inducement.
And the fact that you showed up in your three-piece suit for my defense, really, you know what I mean?
With my spats, yes. Thank you, Doug.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
bud.
Bye-bye. And, in fact, I am Bathrobes Pierre, and I didn't show up at his trial, but I did call up and call back, and you too, if you've got some questions about these laws. I'm not a lawyer, and I can only give you my lay opinion on these issues, which stems to some extent from observing and also being involved in a number of these lower-level cases. You can give me a call at 423-4833 off-air, or you can call online here at 427-3772. I'm definitely not Dr. Dean Adele. I have no degree in these matters, and I have limited experience, but sometimes the experience is worth listening to. If you want to call into the studio now for one reason or another, the number to call is 427-3772.
Now, I'm down here at the Del Mar, and I'm not going to be recording a man because he wishes anonymity, but I want to suggest you might want to check out a guy who's encouraging people to smile as they walk by, and it says, God bless, spare any smiles, hugs, food, or change. So I wish you well, sir, and good luck with your work. A man with a bunny on a leash. Your name, sir?
Shane.
Shane, you were recently evicted from some apartments, and you're recovering, hopefully recovering, a person with AIDS.
Right. Yeah. Well, I just got out of the hospital. All that whole thing actually ended up putting me in the hospital. I had full-blown pneumonia. I couldn't, even though I was in a hotel, the stress was still so much that it...
And, of course, Shane and Donna Dice were the couple we talked about a month ago, were evicted from their apartments after being there for, I don't know, Donna Dice for a decade or more. And this was done after she and Shane had protested the brutalization of Shane on Pacific Avenue by Officer Brierley, a tall, muscular officer who, by Shane's account, assaulted him while he was in handcuffs in a public place, rather nasty handcuffs that Officer Brierley put on him. This is the subject of a story on IndyBay.org, if people want to check it out. Again, Indy, I-N-D-Y, Bay, all one word, IndyBay.org/... all one word, Santa Cruz. Check it out and just look for Donna Dice, D-E-I-S-S, if you want to look through that for that story. And again, this Shane was apparently, as a consequence, this was hospitalized with pneumonia.
And so you're now in a, I know you and Donna Dice fought this eviction. You wrote about it on Indy Bay.
Right.
Hang on. We'll get back to you in a moment. Yeah. All right.
Oh, no, you're right. You know why? Because why should I hold the
horse? This is a conversation with the smile man in front of the Del Mar, who originally didn't want to do much smiling. He wanted me to do the smiling, although he actually was smiling himself. He didn't want to do much chatting. Apparently, he's a survivor of Camp Paradise, or I should say of the destruction of Camp Paradise, which is the homeless camp that was formed for a season or two or three by the San Lorenzo River in 2001, before it was washed away by the floods and by official hostility and negligence by the city. The homeless people, who of course have 1,500 to 2,000 people in the city limits and shelter tonight for less than 45 of them. And a law, of course, that criminalizes sleeping after 11 o'clock at night.
Myself.
Indeed, that's what I was thinking. So we're talking to...
The matter is that I sit down here and I ask for smiles, because most of the kids, they end up sitting there and pulling off a sympathy. I bring joy. I am a light that shines for the Lord. I am His son, He is my father. And you know what? I was sent to do a job, and by golly, I'll do it one way or another.
And we're talking with...
Jason Kelly.
And Jason, how successful has your mission been today?
It's always awesome, because... For every person that I talk to, that's a mustard seed for the Lord. May He reign always.
And what's your feeling about the people that are... What's the mood on the streets as you've been sitting here? Any sense about that?
It always gets brighter when I'm around, because that light shines through and people can't help but smile, because I ask them for a smile and it's free, it's fun, it's for everyone. Brought to you by the Holy Spirit. Thank you very much.
As represented by... You are a representative. You're trying to... Your name again is...
Jason, His son.
Indeed. Anything else you want to pass on to the folks out there in free radio? Free radio land, I should say.
Smile. The Lord loves you.
All right.
God bless.
Hey, thank you, Jason. To the bunny question. What's the name of this bunny, anyway?
Fluffy.
So you have a bunny and a man of the Lord and a man recovering.
We're here at
at Safe Land. It's, oh, no. This is a collection of ne'er-do-wells here about 10:10 on August 30th, Wednesday evening.
SAFE, of course, is the Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, the weekly musical event that's also a feeding event and sometimes a political event. On the sidewalk right outside New Leaf Market in downtown Santa Cruz on Pacific Avenue, which for 2.5 years now has been taking back the sidewalk, playing amplified music, playing music within 10 feet of a kiosk or building, violating a variety of downtown ordinances that have no purpose other than to give the police the power to move along people they don't want there and to essentially discourage people from engaging in any but the most servile kind of presence on Pacific Avenue. It's a repressive and intimidating set of laws. The downtown ordinances, actually Simba Kenyatta, a city council member, I should say a city council aspirant, one who wants to be a city council member, spoke out about questioning or looking into the downtown ordinances in a Good Times description of him and a bunch of other council candidates. And I keep trying to get old Simba Kenyatta to call back so we can see what he's interested in doing and talk on the air about these issues. But for some reason, he has been not either able, willing, or at least he hasn't taken the opportunity to do so. Again, back to SAFE.
Leave Market. Crow is rather agitated, and on the guitar, it's Condor. There's a variety of folks lingering, a couple on the sidewalk, quietly hugging. Lawbreaker Crow, how's it going, Crow?
You know, I've been living on the streets, you know, doing the same old day in and day out.
Well, you know, you had a 2-month permit. You actually got a legal permit for amplified music at the parking lot number 4, Farmers Market, on Wednesday afternoon. What happened to that event? I know, are they still doing
actually,
I gave
that up because of my personal life's going down a shit tube.
Oh, dear.
No, it's not a dear. It's just that's the way that, that's the way it happened.
There you have it. Any reports from the street, putting aside any personal problems?
You know, I've been watching the streets, and, you know, I've been putting homeless people in my vehicles, you know, because I got many of them. You know,
how many vehicles do you have?
Let's say I got 4 of them, and I got a school bus I'm going to put on the street soon. And so far, everything's been lucky for me. You know, I'm just counting my luck. But people have been living in my vehicles, and they've been harassing because they're focusing on the drug activity.
The police are.
Yeah, I hope.
Heroin,
crack, you know, whatever all that shit is. But at least they're not, from my point of view, where people are sleeping in vehicles illegally, they're not being harassed too much, which is a good thing, but to a point.
Now, have people deserted the parking garage structures at night? Do you have any report on that?
I don't. The parking thing has been oblivious to me lately because I don't think actually Santa Cruz wants to do anything about it just yet because I think they're being pressured in a lot of different areas to deal with different stuff. That's my point of view. I think. I don't know if anybody else has anything to report about that.
I haven't heard anything.
No,
I
haven't either.
CJ of the guitar, who usually plays across from clouds in the parking structure, has not been there the last week or two. However, the word is also from Matt Farrell, parking czar, who pushed the parking garage paranoia law, the law that says you can't go in a parking garage unless you have a vehicle, and then only for 15 minutes, that the signs are not yet up, and I haven't actually seen them. So, have you seen them?
No, I haven't seen
them. Signs that say, get out after 15
minutes.
Yeah, I know,
but I haven't seen actually the cops or the parking police enforcing that yet. But if I do, I will be yelling and screaming at them, but I haven't seen it yet. But I've been dealing with, like, you know, the drug activity downtown. And
you mean profiteering from the drug activity?
No, using from the
drug activity. I see. There you have it. Candor. You care to turn yourself in and declare?
You know, they know me. They know my name, but they can't do anything about it. You know,
I mean, get busy, SCPD. Wipe out this scourge.
Yeah, the scourge. Oh yeah, I'm a longtime Santa Cruz citizen. I'll be here for a long time. I know your name. You know my name. You can't do anything about it.
Thank you, Crow.
You're welcome.
Safe event gone tonight. A lot of people. We're, of course, nearing the end.
Yeah, it was hot.
I see Dennis the Menace is showing up here. Or Dennis the Bard, among other things. Any other personalities show up? Any police officers show up? I heard tell that there's a new no amplified sound poster on the other side of the Cafe Campesino, but I'm not sure if that's actually true. That's
how many watts is amplified? Is that
anything with amplification is amplified. So your keyboard wouldn't probably qualify as being amplified. So turn yourself into the police before I have to.
I have a battery-operated, amplificated keyboard. You mean?
I'm afraid you're history, big girl.
Yeah, the electricity's been
cut. Get yourself a permit or get on the move.
Well, permit me. Well, they haven't stepped over here as far as I can tell. There was a big drum here tonight. There was liveliness, yes. And I got here later in the evening. There was a lot of dancing, clapping, good rhythm. And, of course, the 12-string guitar is carrying a lot of the melody because you can hear it now. You can hear it over, you know, all the other things. And there's a lot of interest, a lot of people stopping by saying, it's great, and they're keeping the beat, and they're dancing at their beads, and young lady.
Council members?
No.
That's a blessing.
I'm plotting how to get rid of us, maybe. And they're sad.
The staff do that, actually.
Well, let's try it again.
What should they be thinking of?
How's the food here? I know that Joe Schultz has been providing food. It's been a sort of a macaroni and cheese peanut butter sandwich deal.
Yeah, I know a young woman. I know her because I'm that person who brought some good beans at the end of the evening. And they're still there. Some good pinto beans roasted. Slow cooked, rather. They're still good. They're still eating them. I saw a lot of people eating beans. Somebody brought pizza by.
There you have it. A food panorama at the Safe event. Thank you, Carl Brune. Anything final you wish to pass on before I move on?
I'd like it to continue on and amplify away, I guess. We have
any art exhibits to announce? I understand you do art at other times.
I occasionally have shows. I had a good show at Aromas Day, and that was a street hullabaloo. There's lots of people there dancing in the street, and horses, those Clydesdale horses, what do you call those? The big hoofed horses pulling people around.
Wild horses or hefty horses, horserinis, mega horses.
Yeah, the horses for rent, and they helped move the bike church one time, the wagon. And they were over there, and then a lot of art exhibits over there, a lot of Mexican dancing, and three or four bands. So I had an art exhibit in the park.
No.
We have a community TV man. Sure. You're a community TV worker, are you not?
I have been in the past.
And you're also the infamous John Fuck the Pigs Maurer.
Yes.
And a man who received a large financial settlement, I understand.
I don't want to talk about that right now.
Oh, dear, who once had a large financial settlement. Any reports from the street from you?
None.
All right. Well, take care, sir. And don't overdo it. Yes. And we have a poet who's actually strangely silent, and perhaps mercifully so. How's it going there, Dennis?
The silence is a direct result of having a mouthful of beans.
Oh, no. I knew there was a reason.
I was trained early on not to talk with my mouth full.
Good breeding. And beautiful people dancing as well, I might add.
It's spooky, Robert. It's really spooky. That dance is one of the spookiest things I've ever seen on this sidewalk, and that's the honest-to-goodness truth.
I think it's very sweet. We have a beautiful young woman dancing with her young child, seven- or eight-year-old girl?
Yes, but that's not her child, Robert. It's the child of that other woman over there wiping her face with her hand.
Well, perhaps it's a form of, shall we say, big sisterhood.
I think that's a pretty good characterization, but it's still spooky, if you ask me.
Well, could this be your homophobia sneaking out on us here?
No, it has to do with a very interesting form of Japanese art in which men dress up like Spanish widows with veils over their faces and impersonate Spanish widows. Japanese men do this.
You're not suggesting this apparently attractive female is actually a Japanese man?
No, it just reminded me of that Japanese art form. I was exposed to this up in Missoula, Montana. There's this gringa woman, not a Japanese woman, who has studied this in Japan, and she came and did it in front of us at the, what's it called, the Goat Silk Gallery in Missoula, Montana. They have since moved to Walla Walla Wash, those people. What is their name? Oh, it doesn't matter.
I don't even know, actually, but thank you. Any final words before I leave you here on the sidewalk?
Well, in the mythic government, we now have a department and a secretary of tribute.
How can people get more information about this particular deal?
You should go to the website at Quetzalcoyotl, that's C-O-Y-O, not C-O-A-T-L .org. I'll spell that out. Quetzalcoyotl .org. And read carefully the small print and see what happens to your head.
Sehr gut. Thank you, senor.
Gracias a ustedes todos. And keep listening to this emisora.
Viva Obrador.
Sigan sintonándose. Keep Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We have a few dancers here. What's your name?
Ready to play?
No,
I'm Carmine.
What do you think of all this?
Ask him.
The dancing, I mean. The music. The evening.
I like to do some ballet.
Yeah. And who are you?
I'm Jessica Rose.
And Jessica, what brings you to the sidewalk?
Music. Love. Lots of love.
Dig it.
I'm lots of love, too.
Any comments from the bystanders? How do you like this event?
First, you have to define bystanders.
Oh, well, I don't know. Individuals standing by?
Well, but then you have to define by. Am I by?
It sounds like Bill Clinton.
Me.
So what do you think of this event?
That's a great event. I like it. I like it out there.
And what is your name?
Dion.
And who is this questionable? Should we call him a bystander or a philosophical? I don't know what we're gonna go. So you've been here all evening?
Just for a while. No, just for a little while. Enjoying.
Well, when I got here,
fairly recently.
And this happens every week, and of course it's looks like it's breaking up now, but it looks nice, even in its last stages.
Really following his heart.
Alrighty.
Yeah, Sam. She was my termite.
So your daughter is doing some dancing and flower arranging, and
she's also doing some. The old computer.
This is some for art here.
A computer art, I see. Looks interesting. Insectoid, somewhat insectoid.
Oh, yes. Yeah, also
and rectangular, like various shapes.
Get down, man. Let's try that again. Night after night, we treat you right, baby. It's a get down, man. looking for some songs to play.
And Jessica, you have spent the evening dancing with this young girl. Her name is...
I'm not good with names. I just know people's energy.
Actually, I guess she mentioned earlier on this tape, and you have a very nice outfit on, purple, and you have a sash, and you're looking good. But you might be a little cold tonight. Are you feeling cold?
I'm feeling very warm.
And how are the people treating you out here as you give all... You're stroking my brow as we speak. How are the people treating you?
It's not how people treat you, it's how you emanate love up to your body and see beauty and love and respect and balance and all.
And is that what you see?
Very much so.
Have you been drinking again?
I don't drink. I don't smoke.
Have you been imbibing psychedelic drugs?
No, I'm completely high on a state of mind in bliss. It's wonderful.
You look pretty happy.
I feel weird with you taping me.
Well, the whole Free Radio Santa Cruz is hearing your thoughts on this issue. But they can't really see you, so I'm the one who sees you. I have to interpret you for the audience.
This is beautiful.
Hey, thank you. So I'm pausing in the pizza my heart here to get the latest dope from 12-string guitarist and bike impresario Condor, who has some words about the most recent police ticketing of the tall bike.
Well, hey, this is only stuff I got. Well, I heard a little of it firsthand, but I wasn't there personally. I just heard that on a given ride, say it was last Friday or Friday before last, might have been a critical mass ride or an attempted one. It was essentially one of the riders was given a ticket.
Let's slow this tape recorder down. So take a deep breath and slow down the tape recorder. Continue. Please, spare me. That was not Donald Duck.
Okay.
Well, Woody Woodpecker.
So this young lady, I understand, she's riding this double-high bike. We call it the tall bike. It's one bike frame's been welded onto another. So it's on the books, I understand, something about prohibiting such bikes from being ridden, but I don't think it's enforced very much. But this time, it was. So some of the youth in town build what they call, I guess, freak bikes, and they come into the bike church where I volunteer, and I get to see them. So I heard that one young lady was, in fact, ticketed on this particular ride. And the way it was made sound to me is that the local police had actually tried to sort of corral them or limit their congregating or stop their
critical mass ride.
I believe so. I believe so. I think it was. And what I found of interest was the fact that there was some sort of a ticketing of the young lady. She was singled out. Yeah, that's right. She was too far off the ground. I guess they had to stop and she had to hop down off her bike.
Indeed. Okie doke. Okay, well, it is around 2:40 on August 31st, Thursday afternoon, sunny day. I'm standing on a street that intersects Broadway as it turns into Laurel, right here on the downtown side of the Broadway Laurel Street Bridge. And I'm talking with Valerie Christie, who was homeless in the early 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were saying that this area here, which is now Wheelworks, I guess, the backside of Wheelworks, was the first place where Peter Carota first did his soup kitchen.
He had a truck that he'd bring everything out to feed people.
And how did that go? You were homeless at the time. Were they good meals? How many people attended?
Gee, I don't remember not liking the food. I don't remember it very well. It was a while ago. It was a lot of people. We used to all hang out here together and wait to get food. It was nice. I remember I liked the food okay.
Yeah. And how did the authorities treat this?
I saw no authorities. I don't remember ever seeing any cops or being uncomfortable that someone was looking at us or anything like that.
But you say they were forced to move?
I think they were told to get into another spot, or maybe they wanted a building. I don't know. I just know that they moved to a building across from the boardwalk on Beach Street, and it was like a restaurant. You could walk in and sit down, and they'd serve you like a restaurant. It was really fun. You'd get a bowl of soup, and you'd get bread, and it was really, really fun to go in there like a fantasy land, go like a kid, you know, go and have a restaurant meal, and it was all free.
You were living up in the woods at the time?
No, I was living down here. I was working, and I lived on the streets.
So, what kind of a job did you have?
I worked at Right Livelihood Pizza, which was across from the clock tower. And it was worked really hard for a very piddly amount of money, so I didn't have enough to pay rent.
And how did the pizza place compare with Carota's Kitchen across from the boardwalk?
Well, that was really good. That's whole wheat pizza, rentless cheese. It was excellent, excellent food. And I could go in there anytime I didn't have money, I could get fed because I worked there. So I always had food. I didn't have to worry about that.
And how long, you know, did they stay at the place across from the boardwalk?
Unfortunately, it wasn't very long. I don't remember, but it only felt like a few months. I don't know why. I just know that it wasn't there long.
And where did they move then?
Then they moved to the place they are at now.
On Morris Street?
Is that the name of it? Yeah, behind the lumber company there.
Right, the soup kitchen.
Yes, and I ate there too when they were serving there, and it was good.
Ever suffer any discrimination because you long hair or, you know, when I was concerned with homeless civil rights in the early 90s, the soup kitchen banned activists who were active in, let's say, in fighting the sleeping ban on one occasion or another, working with Food Not Bombs, which was in 1992, a new organization that was formed around the same time as the Union of the Homeless at that time, now defunct, although Food Not Bombs is not. And there was also concern about women having too low-cut a dress and that sort of thing. Was there any concern about that? Oh, I think there was also concern about feeding the deadheads was considered to be a waste of food and time, or it was criticized.
What year was that?
92.
Well, this is 82, and I don't remember any discrimination at all. Most people were hip people. They didn't look like the way they look nowadays. There were a few people like that, you know, dark clothes. But there were a lot of people that were, you know, just wandering around enjoying themselves. They're artists and musicians and people that were free and happy.
Do you ever go to free meals anymore?
I did go over to visit with a friend that's homeless to play music for them, and I didn't actually go there to eat. I went to the Coral Street one for breakfast with him to see what it was like. And
how was it?
I thought it was good food. It was probably slightly low grade, but I know what low grade tastes like, and I didn't think it was that bad.
What kind of food was it?
It was like scrambled eggs and toast, orange juice. You could have cereal and milk if you wanted.
How long ago was this?
Maybe a year ago.
Now, you yourself actually have been providing a meal, or working with people providing a meal at the SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, street performers, street musicians get together every Wednesday in front of New Leaf Market, right?
Yeah, I'm known as the mac and cheese lady.
Indeed.
Yep, and then I also make lemonade and make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and then we play music to entertain and just to get together and make a space where we can all be together and share.
In fact, I think you've inspired, what are we going to call him, Turtle Soup Tim to do his feeding on Monday at the same place in the evenings in front of New Leaf Market in downtown Santa Cruz?
Yeah, I didn't know we inspired him. I just knew that he wanted to feed people, and he decided in the same spot at a different time when most homeless said they don't get fed that day. So he wanted to find days that was available. So Monday is a good day in front of New Leaf.
Now, is there any way that people can donate food to you or to Tim that you know of, or is it something that would be sort of a, is it a difficult matter as far as logistics and so forth?
Well, money would be the best thing because it takes about $10 a week for me to buy what I buy. Anyone who would like to bring food to share, that would be great. We do have people who bring food, and so that's really nice. It's just a way to make it more substantial.
And that's, where should people come with their food and at what time?
Well, I'm usually there about 7 o'clock in front of New Leaf every Wednesday night.
That's at Pacific and Soquel?
Yeah.
We've been talking with?
Valerie.
Thank you, Valerie.
Mm-hmm.
Valerie, you say also that the town clock was a somewhat different scene in the early 80s?
Yeah, that was before first night. And it was, people would crowd around the clock tower before midnight and fill the streets, block the streets. I don't remember seeing, well, there might have been a cop or two, but I don't remember, like, full-force cops. No fences around the clock tower. None of that.
Which, of course, they had this last year.
Uh-huh, that's right. Yeah, and it was, it seemed a little crazy, but nothing really bad any more than first night. And, you know, there was a lot of wild, you know, loud people and lots of people around, but it wasn't anything bad that happened.
Now, what about the police and the homeless? We've heard a lot in the late 70s about Code Blue and how police were actually involved in organized beatings of homeless people. What was your perception of that since you were homeless, what, in 1982?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember any of that. I didn't hear about anything like that. So if it was around, it just didn't get around to me.
Thank you.
And that was an interview today with Valerie Christie on the history of Kuroda's Soup Kitchen, which is now at Mora Street. And in case you're hungry around noon on weekdays, you can go there. I'm not familiar with their current dress or conduct code restrictions. They used to have a, they discouraged you from giving out literature about civil rights for the homeless. They tore down flyers that announced meetings of people trying to get together for their civil rights. I don't know what they're doing now. It depends on who the boss in charge at the moment is, or indeed who the people reading the bulletin board are. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and we'll be going for another half hour with my show, to be followed by Uncle Dennis and From the Cream to the Dregs. 3 hours of 60s and 70s classic music. Check it out. He plays some good tunes and does some updates on Earth First current issues. So check out Uncle Dennis. About 8 o'clock, he's be coming into the studio. I'll be coming back on Sundays at 9:30, and I think I'll be having a special guest by phone, Reva Entine, her name is. Reva has been on the show before. She worked for a long time with the National Lawyers Guild in San Francisco and then became a reformer trying to add a community voice to the Pacifica Foundation for radio station KPFA, which has developed a number of problems from her perspective. And she's talked about problems in the past, ranging from the banning of ancient lefty William Mandel. Democracy Now was Democracy Now in exile for a long time because Pacifica had banned Democracy Now, or KPFA had anyway. And it had to do with kind of the supremacy of the staff there. And apparently the same kinds of problems, according to Reva, are still with us, and I wish the internet were working in the studio here and I could actually pull up the email I got from her, but she's assured me that she will be phoning in at 10:30 in the morning on Sunday. So perhaps if you want to come back at that time, 4 days hence, or actually 3 days hence, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you can hear that conversation and get the latest update on that great liberal KPFA and how it ain't so liberal these days. Or, well, let's put this way, some concerns she and others have about it and some proposals for improvement that they're going to put forward. That's Reva Entine, 10:30 on Sunday. I'm going to be kind of jumping around a little bit now. Let's leap back, 24 years. Is that how far back it is? It's 14 years to 19. Well, actually, no, it's 18 years to 1988 when I actually first began really active, high-profile work in Santa Cruz as an activist, civil rights activist, with ties to the homeless movement, concerned about issues like the sleeping ban, police misconduct, city council lack of accountability. And the city council race of 1988 was quite a race. I think it had 15 different candidates for, it was either three or four seats. I'm not sure which. I think the ultimate winners were, for those who remember these things, Don Lane, Mo Reisch, who shortly thereafter resigned under threat of recall. Marty Wormhout, I believe, was also reelected. And Jane Yokoyama, who we call Jane Hokey Mama because of her bogus liberalism, at least in terms of homeless issues. That was pretty much the, and still is pretty much the reality of people get elected to city council in Santa Cruz. This time running for city council, we have, of course, Mike Riot Act Rotkin, Cynthia Two-Minute Matthews, and then a bunch of kind of new faces, or not so new, actually. Bruce Van Allen, who was on the city council and was elected with Rotkin way back in 1979. Christopher Cobb, Lynn Robinson, and Simba Kenyatta. Now, the four new candidates, other than Matthews and Rotkin, are profiled by Peter Cott in The Good Times, which came out today. I keep hoping I can get these people to call me back here at Free Radio. I think I've called all of them but Lynn Robinson, who is a nice enough person. She's accessible in many respects. She returns her phone calls, at least she did about a year ago when I called her, and people do change. Witness Emily Riley when she was elected to city council. There was quite a change there from homeless advocate to homeless scourge. Interesting. But, you know, I don't know how Lynn's going to do. Lynn is, however, closely tied with the business community. They all look pretty closely tied, except maybe for Simba Kenyatta, who's an African-American. And there's the most space given in this article is to, looks like Bruce Van Allen gets the most space. Let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs. Robinson gets 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs. Kenyatta, the only really liberal candidate, you might even say progressive candidate, gets 1, 2, 3, 4, 3 paragraphs. And Cobb, who's a newcomer, gets 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs in this article. Again, out in the Good Times, which you can pick up on a trash heap near you, I mean on a pile of free newspapers near you, often in laundromats and bookstores and so forth. It's titled, And They're Off. The contenders step forward to contest Mike Rotkin and Cynthia Matthews for three open city council seats in Santa Cruz. There is an interesting three paragraphs talking about Simba Kenyatta, which read as follows. Simba Kenyatta is throwing his hat into the ring to work on social and economic justice issues and will draw upon his background in conflict resolution to try to mitigate some of Santa Cruz's recent gang activities. The problem is that we have a tendency to look to law enforcement for solutions to that problem, Kenyatta says via phone. Law enforcement, by definition, is reactive, not proactive. We have to spend some time looking at the downtown ordinances and what their purposes are. Of course, the downtown ordinances don't have a lot of impact on gang members. They don't spend much time downtown, as far as I know. They do affect homeless people, young people, elderly people who live there, musicians, street performers, political activists, tablers, and just ordinary folks who somehow have the misimpression that the public sidewalks belong to the community and not to the merchants and the police department. So Kenyatta's a little off, or whoever writes this story, maybe Cott is a little off in suggesting this has much to do with the downtown ordinances don't have a lot to do with gangs, but still, his interest in the downtown ordinances is a good thing, and he has been interested in these for some time. Kenyatta's concern over the downtown ordinance, as the article continues, is part of what he views as one of the city's biggest problems. Quote, the usual undeclared internecine class war that takes place downtown all too often. And to that end, he supports the minimum wage increase as well as the increase in the sales tax to forestall further budget deficits and improve public services. I feel that my extensive training in conflict resolution and coalition building, along with my experience with youth and gangs, combine to make my assets perfect for the times. He says, before adding, I also would like to see an African-American person at long last represented in Santa Cruz politics. And he is, of course, black. And I, as I said, I've called this, called Simba, who I know, at least three or four times. I got his son, I believe, yesterday, and I haven't been able to get him to call back. Now, perhaps he's got some problems. Perhaps he's decided that this is not the best forum for him. Perhaps he is afraid of the sharp questioning that I might give him, having failed to support bogus progressive Christopher Crone and his supervisor's race against Neil Coonerty. Actually ran into Crone on the streets a couple days ago. And we had a long chat, surprising. I enjoy talking to anybody. And so, you know, even Rotkin and I will babble on at length, to my chagrin, at different points. Christopher was wondering why he'd lost the race and how could that have happened, and my perspective was, well, you didn't stand for much, as at least from the point of view of, based upon your experience. Somebody else put it differently. I don't know if she wants to be publicly quoted, so I won't quote her, but she said that Crone had no backbone. That was the problem. He couldn't stand up strongly for an issue, and under pressure he would melt. This was seen most graphically at the city council meeting of March 12th or something of 2002, when he was mayor, when Fitzmaurice, seeing me give a mock Nazi salute in the back after Crone had made a bad call and cut off a speaker and threatened to arrest her, and then demanded I leave the room because Fitzmaurice wanted me to, and created a disruption of the council meeting, similar to what I'm being charged with here in on September 25th, and I'll be going to trial on, unless that trial is canceled. The problem he had was, I don't think he himself would have said, arrest the guy, but he let Fitzmaurice, you know, be the judge. He should have said to Fitzmaurice, if you want to arrest him, we'll stop the meeting and you can have issue a citizen's arrest. And that would have put the responsibility where it belonged, up the, frankly, tight-assed behavior of Tim Fitzmaurice. And it's interesting, Fitzmaurice, sadly enough, has become the most liberal member of the Santa Cruz City Council on a number of issues, although not enough of the issues to really suggest he's changed in any meaningful, consistent way. You know, he opposed the parking garage paranoia law, the 15-minute law for those who have cars and bicycles, the zero-minute law for those who want to walk through a parking garage and don't have a vehicle there. It's now illegal. These are now forbidden zones in the parking garages. Even if you want to put a flyer on a car, as of now, that's illegal. Although they aren't enforcing these laws, they are now on the books, just as it's suddenly the power of Danette Shoemaker, the Parks and Rec czar, to declare any areas of Santa Cruz that Parks and Rec patrols closed, new closing hours, without going through any kind of public process at the Parks and Rec Commission. And we didn't hear Christopher Crone standing up and opposing any of this stuff. We didn't hear Bruce Van Allen or Simba Kenyatta or Christopher Cobb or Lynn Robinson opposing this crap that was done by Matthews and Rotkin, who are running for city council. So, you know, it's a painful, frustrating process to go to city council. And earlier today I've talked about how it may not be worth it at all. But if you're going to be running for city council, you sure as hell better either be there or else be organizing mobs of people and, you know, mass organizations in the streets that will stop this kind of crap. And if you're not doing that, then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you're building up shit for your resume in these city council races. I mean, that's the feeling I have. But you out there listening to this, and I hope someone is listening, may have a different perspective. The number to call is 427-3772, 427-FRSC, if you'd like to give a different point of view. Again, the article that I was reading from was and They're Off in the Good Times. And it's, you can check it out yourself. I only read a part of it, the part relating to Simba Kenyatta. Lynn Robinson opposes the minimum wage ordinance. Bruce Van Allen supports it, which is nice. Bruce Van Allen is... He prides himself as being the only council member who ever opposed the sleeping ban, or whoever, the only mayor who actively opposed the sleeping ban, although Crone can probably say that too, because he actually voted in favor of suspending the sleeping ban in 1998. He and Sugar were the only two who did that. But the problem was they never followed up on it. They had 4 years to follow up on that vote, and having been lambasted by the police department and the Sentinel, never got enough guts together to do shit after that. So Bruce Van Allen, I suspect, is going to be a similar character, but who knows? I mean, I can happy to have him appear on the air, you know, speak about this issue, any of these people, Lynn Robinson included. I'd love to have them talk about the civil rights issues downtown. Give me a whack at them. Ray Glock Gruenike was a civil rights attorney who for two decades fought for the rights of poor and homeless people. Then he got swamped and lost his, he was disbarred, and he's still fighting to get his law license back. He did that because he got deluged with cases, and he screwed up on some of them while trying to help so many people. He did help many, many people. He's currently a legal worker, and I'm going to play now a selection from 1988, the council race back then that I was referring to earlier, where there were 15 candidates. And actually, there was a homeless candidate, Jane Immler, running. Hassan, an African-American, was running. There were a variety. Ed Porter, actually, was running, and he talked about the need for a campground. Hey, Ed, how about that? You know, it looks like you've gotten so right-wing in the last two decades, you can't even propose a campground anymore, even though that means 1,500 people are outside tonight because you won't propose a campground. It's a sad thing. But anyway, here's a discussion where Ray Glock Gruenike, who is actively, he has an attorney, was actively defending a lot of homeless people who were doing mass protests against the sleeping ban, criticizes Arnie Levine. Arnie Levine is a council member who was running for re-election, who was defeated. He's actually a nice guy who works in the Sentinel now. I say hello to him when I see him in there. But he was conservative. And like other council members, he sucked on homeless issues. Here's Ray Glock Gruenike talking about these issues on the radio at that time. Again, we're talking 1988, probably October, September or October.
I say that for a very specific reason. The camping warrants are always made to have less than $1,000 bail, so that and under the law you do not extradite from another county when the bail is set at less than $1,000. So it's not a technique to get them back here and recycled in, rather it's a technique to shove them out of the county. It's an exportation program, and it's been a long honored kind of policy that we've been using for lots of poor people, is they can't face court, to shove them out of the county with a threat of an arrest warrant that will only be enforceable inside the county. So it's a deportation program that's going on. But since every other county is doing the same thing with their poverty people, we tend to be shunting our poor people back and forth between the counties. And if you ever want a really eloquent description of that process, in the European context, read Down and Out in Paris and London by George Orwell, and you get the picture of what it's about.
Okay, do you have a question?
Yes.
Please. We're waiting.
Okay.
And this is Michael Zwirling of KSCO, and this is where the City Council Forum, I believe, was happening, again, back in 1988.
This question is mostly addressed to the other three.
That is, this is Ray Glock Gruenike on Michael Zwirling's show.
Arnie dodged the previous question entirely about what the role of the City Council is by correctly pointing out that it wasn't recycling. The City Council's present policies are disastrous and persecutive. How can you, Arnie, since I know you personally to be a decent human being, how can you possibly justify the impact of this indecent law on the lives of the people who do not, in fact, have a place to sleep. And that is the housing element, Mr. Weber, whether you want to recognize it or not, of many of these people. How can you justify a continuation of that policy? Rather than going on with more speech, I'll hang up and let you folks answer that.
Thanks very much. Let's keep it brief if we possibly can.
Maybe 30 seconds per.
Let's let Don Weber answer this one.
Yeah, I don't mean to say that there are not people in the community that we call homeless that don't have a home. I understand that that is a portion of the problem. I don't think giving them a home, whether it's temporary or permanent, and not to mention the fact that we might not be able to afford it, is necessarily solving their problem. It may well be solving our problem in the sense that we don't see them anymore and they're out of our vision. But I don't believe that it's we serve either them or ourselves if we fail to figure out exactly what their problem is. I agreed that there is probably a good portion of them that either can't afford an apartment or sleep in their car or whatever, but that doesn't happen. There's a story behind that. What's the story? What is their real problem? I don't believe it's a housing solution is going to solve the real problem.
Thank you, Don Weber. How about Arnie Levine, since you referred to numerous times?
Well, it's a very complex issue, and I cannot see. The more you get into this thing, the more roadblocks are put in the way. Your first impulse as a citizen, or as I did on the council the first year, when we had those tremendously cold, wet, rainy, hard, rainy nights, I suggested we were building a third deck on the parking garage downtown. I said, well, they all have a sleeping roll. Let them use the second deck. It'll be covered. We can always put a tarp down on one side. They could use it after a certain hour at night, and then they could, they'd have to leave early in the morning so that it doesn't interfere with the prime function of the structure. I also thought that there should be while we were building the third deck, to put in some bathroom facilities. But there's only one public bathroom downtown, and that's on Soquel Avenue. But these are as I became more aware of responsibilities to the city as a whole, I find that there are, you might say, roadblocks, quote unquote, that come to that kind of thinking. And you have to look at the entire picture and what risks the city has to take. And the city has done, what the city has done is to gather resources. And we bought this place from the university. We put in as many as we can. We're remodeling the thing to hold more people.
And what Arnie Levine is saying, of course, what Don Weber said, again, this is back in 1988, was, oh, we can't afford to build them houses, and that wouldn't help anyway, because the reasons they're homeless, they probably, in essence, he's implying they'd lose their houses, which, of course, is a bunch of crap. People are homeless for a variety of reasons. And what was being an issue is not whether people should be built houses, but rather whether they should be arrested for sleeping under city law when there's no shelters for them, which is, of course, the same question we face tonight in 2006. The response of Arnie Levine, who actually did propose, as a conservative, interestingly enough, because he was considered a conservative in the council, set up a temporary shelter in the second floor of the parking garage, which is, I guess, next to... it's near the river, the River Street Garage, I guess it's called. And actually that was proposed again in 1998 by Becky Johnson and by some members of the Homeless Issues Task Force considered it. It was rejected because there wasn't a sprinkler system in there or some crap, which had nothing to do with the real needs of the situation. Again, there's always an excuse, always a pretext. And when Arnie talks about having some kind of shelter, you're hearing a lot of bureaucratic double talk. There was a so-called River Street mini shelter, which we still have, although it's been expanded to 36 beds. It then had, I think, 14 beds, two of which were for homeless people and 12 of which were for mental health people. And that was out of a homeless population, which was, I think we estimated at 500 to 1,000, probably significantly more. Now, of course, it's 1,500 to 2,000. Again, returning to the 1988 city council race on KSCO, a forum which I recorded off the radio at that time, at least part of it.
There are 17 public agencies within a block and a half of the mall that service these people. made people come to that. It's a very difficult situation.
Thank you, Arnie Levine.
We're willing to listen to it.
We apologize, Don Lane and Jane Immler. We should move on to our next call, please.
And that's rather interesting, because Don Lane and Jane Immler were the two people who actually had more liberal responses to this. Jane Immler, of course, wanted to end the sleeping ban. Don Lane was talking about a moratorium and reform. And he actually, on his first council meeting, when he was elected, tried to bring up the issue and was slapped down by the entire council and never was heard from again on that issue.
Now to line three, where Maya from Santa Cruz has been waiting. Hello, Maya. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, my question is to all of the candidates. I wonder how they feel about alleviating the housing crunch by allowing granny units and additional kitchens and bathrooms in existing houses and making it easy for the owners of larger houses, say, that have children anymore and that the owners would like to stay there and just rent out extra rooms without the need to share their private kitchen and bath. I went to Europe and they give people like that a tax deduction when they do build an extra kitchen. And it seems to me a good idea to better make use of what we have than building on new land.
It seems to be even closer to home than that, Maya. It's my understanding that the city of Berkeley encourages additional housing units within a residential structure as well. But that's a very, very good question, and I can't wait to hear the responses from the council.
Can we start with Don on this, Mike?
Sure.
Don Lane?
Sure.
I think it's generally an excellent idea. I think my only caution is that we do need to make sure that the impacts on the neighborhoods are taken care of as we do build second units and granny units, because there are some real parking problems in some neighborhoods, and if we add an additional unit, then that's probably an additional car. And I think it's just important to make sure that as we allow these units to be added, that problems like parking are dealt with. But I do think this is a better approach than expanding outward in the city. I think we do need to look for opportunities to develop in areas that are already developed. I think people in Santa Cruz really like our open space and the green belt, and I think if we're going to provide some more housing, this is a good way to go.
Very briefly, Jane Immler, would you respond?
Yes, that's one of the things I've been talking about throughout this election. I'd like to see that as a way, granny units, legal granny units, and also the encouraging of second-story additions to houses rather than focusing all of our attention on the Community Development Housing Corp.
What about the grandfathering in of units, housing units, which were built prior to zoning laws, but which would meet code? How do you feel about that?
I would support that.
Okay. Don Weber?
Can't answer that last.
And it's getting a little far afield from civil rights for the homeless, although granny units are housing, and that's an important issue kind of as a secondary matter. Turning to a few more street interviews as we wait for Uncle Dennis to show up at the studio, which should happen momentarily, or for you, whoever you may be out there, to call in the last 5 minutes of this show, Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'll be back on Sunday, and that'll be happening at 9:30 in the morning. And, of course, Thomas Levitt's The Wake-Up Call. He may be playing some tapes from this ancient era, too, around homeless civil rights issues and relating them to our current day, which is actually quite illuminating. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Let's hear a few more street interviews, and then you can relax with some music from Uncle Dennis.
Emily. Yes.
Hang on just a second while we put this together here.
Billing State.
We danced a little, leaned across the cell, and a grass man forbid the stars.
And we're listening to the music of C.J. Stock in the parking garage right across from Clouds here on whatever street this is. Illegally, I might add, since we are, well, it's 15 to 7 on July 10th, Monday, a full week and a half after the, 2 weeks and a half after the City Council's 15-minute trespass law has gone into effect. And here he is, strumming away with a companion sitting with him, neither of them apparently being hassled at the moment, next to the bicycle stand. As the sun sets in the west, and on the other side of the sign, which talks about free public parking but criminalizes the parking lot for homeless people, though I don't see those signs posted yet, there's a scotch tape sign: police have been spying on us, they could spy on you next. So, C.J., what kind of a criminal are you, strumming in a parking garage without a vehicle? Where's your car?
I don't got one.
Well, that's no excuse. You know, this is a public garage, but only for those with vehicles and bicycles.
Seems that's a little prejudiced.
Well, we've never said that Santa Cruz doesn't have its little faults.
Yeah, you know what? I'm just going to wait to see what happens.
How long have you been strumming today?
I've been playing for hours. Not here, though. I've been all over the place.
You didn't have any problem here?
Mm-hmm.
Not here. Strumming here in the garage.
Well, they don't have the signs up yet.
No.
Supposedly, once they get the signs up, I could receive some hassle. And then we'll talk about that.
All right, then. And you've had some promises from some local attorney to assist you in that, right?
Not a local attorney, but a very good friend of mine, yes. Yeah.
Well, we hope that you are successful, and we hope to learn more as the evening proceeds, or evenings
we'll
proceed.
They haven't hassled me yet. Not yet.
Good. And it's violin and guitar downtown here. In front of the Gelato Mania Cafe. Actually, it's somewhat to the right of it, so not in violation of that downtown ordinance, but these two are, in fact, seated on public property, namely the planter that is near Gelato Mania. Well, it's nearly midnight.
I've got a live singular webcam right now.
Oh, well. On Pacific Avenue here, and I'm talking with
Mr. Westcott.
And Mr. Westcott, it's kind of a cool evening, but there's still a lot of cars on the street as we stand across from Pizza My Heart. And you actually have had interactions with the police three times in the last year?
About seven arrests in the last 11 months.
And have you been any convictions for any of these arrests?
No.
And what were the arrests for?
242 on a police officer two times.
It's an assault on a police officer?
Yes.
And do you regard yourself as an aggressive person who seeks out police officers, or do you feel you yourself had some problem where they actually approached you and caused you a problem?
That's a good question, John. Can you ask me that question one more time?
Sure. Let's take a case. The first time this happened, give me a description of what went down.
What went down on?
One of these instances in the last year.
November 10th at SoCal and Ocean at the Chevron station was that the police detained me. Kay Rogers detained me and ordered me off my bike and threatened to mace me at Chevron. on November 10th. At, once again, at SoCal and Ocean, and she code for me, which is with 5150, and then she threatened to mace me, and I told her, F-U-P-I-G.
Fuck you, pig.
Go ahead and mace me, and she then code 2'd me, and three Santa Cruz PD showed up in squad cars, and I defended myself. I used a reasonable force to defend myself against the police, and I was, my head was slammed to the ground. I was blacked out and put in handcuffs.
You know the names of the officers who took you down?
No, I don't.
And you, how many officers were eventually involved in this case?
At least seven.
And were these all Santa Cruz police officers or another department?
All SCPD.
And did you know, did you know officer, you say Rogers was her, what was her name and the name of the initial officer?
Kay Rogers, female officer. I believe her badge number is 147, but I'm not sure.
Had, did you two know each other from before?
I've never met her before, no.
And so the incident was you were riding on your bike from one place to another and she stopped you?
She ordered me to get off my bike, which was, I got to put a plug in for Dave's Custom Bike Shop on SoCal. I bought a brand new K2 mountain bike, and that's the mountain bike that I was detained on for no headlight.
And what time of day or night was it?
That was about 1:30 a.m. on November 10th, I believe. It might have been about 11:30. I don't have
that. Anyway, we're going to... just sort of leave that interview there and thank Robert once again for bringing us up to date on homeless rights issues. He, of course, will be back on Sunday at, 9:30. An ungodly hour for a Sunday morning, but he's been doing it for years, so I guess he's used to it. Anyway, I'm Uncle Dennis. I'm here in the studio till 11 o'clock tonight on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org out on the World Wide Weird Web. And, of course, it's good to be back. I've been off in various places of the world and had interesting adventures, and I will tell you all about them later. Of course, Brew of the Week coming up in just a little while. Earth First Update at 9 o'clock and Mystery Group at 10. But there's no mystery about who this group is.
but must